to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you today. Our quote for the day from Albert Einstein: the discovery of the nuclear chain reactions need not bring about the destruction of mankind any more than did the discovery of matches. We only must do everything in our power to safeguard against its abuse. Well, interesting. It's one of the forms of the abuse of the chain reaction, nuclear power. We're going to get into that in just a moment here. First, I just wanted to, yesterday I had been talking about refining uranium and whatnot, and several listeners wrote to me to set the record straight. No, it's uranium hexafluoride. It's a gas. It's not a solid. It's the 235, the fissile isotope, not 238. So they're looking for the lighter stuff, not the heavier stuff. So anyhow, I stand corrected on how centrifuges work. That said, Gwyneth Cravens is with us. CravensPowerToSaveTheWorld.com, her website, Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy, her book. Gwyneth Cravens, a novelist who has written a long and detailed book about the wonders of nuclear power. Gwyneth, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'm wondering why, as a novelist, you would write something that I would think a scientist or a science writer would be writing.
Well, I've done science writing about mainly epidemiological matters and for Harper's and the New York Times Magazine, but I'm not a scientist. I am a novelist, and what interested me ultimately about doing this book was that it's a book about prejudice. Niels Bohr talked about the relentless goal of science being the gradual removal of prejudice. By prejudice, Bohr meant belief unsupported by evidence. And I had a lot of beliefs, and to my surprise, I turned out to be wrong about them, that they weren't based in science. So that's the book is the story of my journey from fiction to fact, you might
yeah.
say.
Well, most of the book is about your conversations with Rip Anderson, this guy that you describe as having curly, receding gray hair, a full mustache, blue eyes, wiry build, flannel shirt, almost like a somebody out of a Western. You're describing this guy
he
as
is Western.
Romantic
he grew up
character.
On a ranch. He was a foreman on his father's ranch and a rodeo cowboy in his youth. But he went on to become a chemist, an oceanographer, an expert in probabilistic risk assessment. It's a methodology that he pioneered that's used all over the world. And he's an environmental activist, and he and his wife saved a piece of land where there was an old airstrip in Albuquerque and turned it into a bird sanctuary. And he campaigns in New Mexico for clean air and clean water.
Right, and for atomic power. And I'm just wondering why so much of him and not any of Helen Caldicott.
Because Helen Caldicott is not a scientist, and her information is mostly wrong.
She has a PhD in medicine.
I know, but that doesn't
and
make
And we're talking
her...
about the consequences of nuclear radiation on human beings.
Would
she's,
you?
She's very much a scientist.
But she's really wrong, and a lot of people who are opposed to nuclear power are kind of embarrassed by her lack of grasp of the facts.
Well, and here's the question. You have only one page in your book, page 124, in which you mention the Price-Anderson Act. If nuclear power is so safe and is so great, then why is it that no insurance company in the world will insure a nuclear power plant?
Well, that's not true. The insurance, the nuclear plants in the United States are self-insured. They pay into a pool which is controlled by insurance companies, and it's a way for them to get rich because they...
Because there hasn't been an accident yet.
They paid out for distress around Three Mile Island, but there were no deaths or illnesses, and they paid out on a couple of other occasions for small problems, but again, not health-related.
You point out that this pool has $10 billion in it.
Correct.
Mohammed Atta had intended to crash one of the planes into Indian Point nuclear power plant, which
that doesn't
would have,
mean he could do it.
He could have easily done it.
No,
there is. He wasn't going to crash it into the reactor.
Excuse
he was going to crash it into the pool
even
outside
harder,
the reactor.
Even harder. If you read my book, you'll see that there's a law of physics called ground effect, that the faster a plane is
going... I'm a pilot. I know what ground effect is.
Okay,
if you're coming in horizontally, ground effect does reduce your stall speed by about 10 knots. A, that's largely irrelevant. And B, and if you're pointing a plane straight down like a missile, there's no such thing as ground effect.
Well, I challenge the any pilot, including a Blue Angel, to be able to auger down into something as small as a spent fuel pool. About, you know, they're about the size of an Olympic swimming pool.
About the
and
size
the
of, this, of the side of the World Trade Center?
And, pardon?
About the size of the side of the World Trade Center?
Oh, no. And also,
the, side of
the World Trade Center and the Pentagon are two of the biggest buildings in the world. The buildings at a nuclear plant are small, and they are heavily fortified, and the walls of the containment building are like 5 feet
thick. So back to my question.
And the plant, let me finish.
The plane would be shredded by overhead cranes
in the spent fuel pool.
Yeah.
So forget it. It's not going to happen.
Well, let's hope you're right. But again, you're saying that this $10 billion fund that the nuclear industry has got together is going to be enough. If Indian Point goes down, you think that the total limit of the liability is going to be $10 billion if all of New York City is left, is rendered unlivable for the next 100,000 years?
First of all, that defies the laws of physics. It would not happen.
No, it defies the laws of economics. That's why the Price-Anderson Act was passed. Price-Anderson is the only thing that allows the nuclear industry to exist in the United States.
Let's be polite here, Tom. We both want something very important, which is reduction in carbon emissions. And the things you're talking about, if you read the book, I discovered that these assumptions, and I had the same wrong assumptions you have about the vulnerability of a nuclear plant, it's just not the case from a point of view of science. The spent fuel would not spread all over Kingdom Come. That is a hypothetical when you assume that every particle in the spent fuel would be uniformly distributed over a wide area due to weather conditions. This can't happen in the real world. In the real world, and we have a real world experiment in terms of Three Mile Island, which had a partial core meltdown, and where did the radioactive material go? It plated out on the inside of the pressure vessel. That's where it went.
Gwyneth, we have an industry here that exists by virtue of government subsidies. We're talking about $15 billion in the next appropriation. We're an industry that exists because the government, through the Price-Anderson Act, says we'll be the insurer of last resort. In other words, all of us will take liability of it, and it limits the liability of this industry, unlike any other power-generating industry.
Right.
And it's costing us a fortune and is creating toxic waste that will be deadly for tens or hundreds of thousands of years. I don't get it why you would be so aggressive in your support of this when there are alternatives. Wind power right now is
it's not baseload, Tom.
Wind power right now is less expensive than nuclear power.
I like wind power, but will you listen? Can I talk for a minute, please? You know, I'm a supporter of Air America, and I feel I should get my chance to say something. We're talking because we're using electricity, and there would be no Air America without electricity. We have three sources of baseload electricity. Baseload is a 24/7 reliable, steady source of electricity. We have three generators of that. Fossil fuel combustion, which is destroying the environment, killing 24,000 Americans from coal alone in the United States, and screwing up the global temperature. We have hydroelectric. We have dammed every river we can in the United States. It's a finite resource. We get only 5% of our electricity from that. And we have nuclear power. Those are the three large-scale providers of baseload energy. Wind and solar are great. They can be supplemental. Let's increase them. But they cannot take over running factories and so on. They can do a bit. They can do peak loads and stuff like that. But the choice gets down to burning more coal, which is the coal industry's plan, and using more nuclear power.
If the entire world was using nuclear power right now, there would be 8 years' worth of uranium left in the world. This is not true.
I'm sorry. You're getting your information from unscientific, unpeer-reviewed, unsupported sources. I'm sorry to tell you. There is enough uranium in the world for hundreds of years of reactors to operate. And furthermore, they haven't even begun to recycle it.
That's assuming that you continuously recycle it.
It's not. It's assuming one time through. They haven't even begun to prospect for uranium. There's so much out there. It's a very common element in the Earth's crust. It's as common as tin.
And you're not at all worried about radiation?
I am worried about the radiation given off and uncontrolled by coal-fired plants. So they give off 100 to 400 times more than any nuclear plant.
Okay. Well, people can check it out and make up their own mind. Gwyneth Cravens, CravensPowerToSaveTheWorld.com is the website. And the book, Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy. Gwyneth Cravens, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Bye.
We're talking about 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 16% of the world's electricity now coming from nuclear energy. 85% of that is coming out of industrialized countries. 103 nuclear power plants in the United States, providing 20% of the nation's electricity. George Bush wants $15 billion from your tax dollars and mine to build six or seven new nuclear plants. In the year 2000, just to go back to the last year that we've got, I think, fairly reliable statistics, an estimated 310 tons, 620,000 pounds of weapons-usable plutonium was produced in nuclear reactors, in civilian reactors. Less than 8 kilograms, 18 pounds of plutonium is enough for a Nagasaki-style bomb. Thus, in just the year 2000, we created in our nuclear power plants enough plutonium to make 34,000 Nagasaki-type nuclear weapons. A typical reactor will generate 20 to 30 tons of high-level waste, nuclear waste, annually, and right now, no known way to safely dispose of this waste. Now, I realize Gwyneth would argue with that. She suggests that there are known and safe ways. Why are we not using them? Well, it's all politics? Well, actually, she's not here. I'm not going to debate her. She can't defend herself, and I'm not going to pick on somebody who can't. But I just, broadly speaking, setting aside Gwyneth in her book, and she's a brilliant writer, and it's a very interesting book. Setting that aside, this whole issue of how are we going to power our future, there are a lot of ways, you know, and one of the arguments that's made is that wind power and solar power generate electricity when the sun is out or when the wind is blowing, but not when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't out, and so what are you going to do? There's a lot of ways to store energy. Geothermal is a great way to store energy. People do this to some extent with heat pumps in their homes. During the winter, they pump heat into the ground. During the summer, they pump cool out of the ground, as it were. They pump heat back into the ground. And the same thing could be done, for electricity. Another way is using solar power or wind power to electrolyze water and create hydrogen and store the hydrogen and then burn the hydrogen later when you need to, and producing no waste at all. Nothing nuclear, no carbon dioxide, nothing. The most primitive and oldest is, you know, creating an artificial lake and pumping water up into it when you have a surplus of electricity, and then letting that water run back down and run turbines to generate electricity when you need the electricity. I mean, there's a lot. This is actually used in Canada rather extensively. Canada Hydro, Quebec Hydro, up north of Vermont, where I used to live, uses that technique a lot. In fact, you know, they sell that power in Vermont as green power. And the state of Vermont, when I used to live there, bought a lot of electricity from Quebec Hydro, or I believe that was the name of the company. And actually, there was a lot of debate about how green it was, because, you know, it was damming up rivers, and, you know, is that all that green, really? Well, it's now we're facing the possibility of not even, you know, having controllable rivers as a consequence. Well, here in the Pacific Northwest, we're seeing this wild flooding right now. Is it the consequence of global warming? You know, 9 out of the last 10 years, the hottest, warmest years in history, in world history. And we just hit an all-time record for temperature here in the Pacific Northwest. I'm not a climatologist, I don't have the detailed records here, but based on what our local weatherman is saying, we've never had winds over 100 miles an hour. And we had 129-mile-an-hour winds. I mean, this is incredible. And so at some point we've got to say, and like right now would be a good time to do it while this meeting is going on in Bali, to come up with a new version of the Kyoto Treaty, which is 10 years right now. I think it's today, if not this week. Now is a good time to sit down and say, okay, enough already with the carbon dioxide. And are we going to trade emitting carbon dioxide, which is producing all kinds of unintended consequences and disastrous effects, with, okay, we won't emit carbon dioxide anymore. Instead, we'll emit radiation. Setting aside the fact that you have to use fossil fuels to find the uranium, to refine the uranium, to transport the uranium, setting aside all that, and in fact, there's actually some, I have a study here by Jan Willem Storm, Van Leeuwen, and Philip Smith, Nuclear Power, the Energy Balance of CO2 Emission in the Nuclear Life Cycle. It talks about how, initially, nuclear power plants don't generate much carbon dioxide. But over time, over 20, 30, 40-year period, nuclear power plants will generate the production of carbon dioxide from a nuclear power plant can get up to the point where it's 400 parts. What are my details? Here we are. 400 grams of carbon per kilowatt. This would be by 2070, uranium-fueled nuclear power would produce as much carbon dioxide as a gas-fired power station, or 400 grams of carbon per kilowatt. The report says the claims of the nuclear industry that nuclear power emits low levels of CO2 and other greenhouse gases is not based on scientifically verifiable evidence. Coal, which produces 755 grams of carbon per kilowatt, seems, it's great, because right now nuclear power is between 10 and 150 grams per kilowatt hour. That's the carbon produced in mining and refining and transporting uranium. Wind power, 11 to 37 grams per kilowatt hour. That's the carbon dioxide produced in the manufacture of the wind turbines. But over its lifetime, over their lifetime, solar panels just kind of eventually fade away. Wind power generators may need maintenance. But nuclear waste has to be stored, has to be transported, has to be refined. All these things ultimately will be producing carbon dioxide. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Jimmy Barr, oh, I screwed the country. They still think I'm a star. Hear neighbors, trust their neighbors. That's why I tap their phones. It keeps their freedom ringing. And I feel less alone. Even though I love them, that's just where I'm at. Besides, rumor has it that one's a Democrat. Let's go to Mars.
34 minutes past the hour.
Cares,
tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, I'll be at the Willamette Store at Willamette University, 900 State Street, Salem, Oregon. They're going to have all of my books there, and they're going to have a substantial discount on them. So check that out if you live in the Salem, Oregon area. And on next Friday, December 14th, at 7 p.m., I'll be at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Memorial Union. And feel free to drop by. You can get more information on all those things over at tomhartman.com. Our schedule. This thing with Mike Huckabee is really interesting, that Mike Huckabee has pardoned this guy who was a murderer, was a rapist. And after he was pardoned, he went out and he raped and murdered another woman. He had not murdered the first woman that he raped, although she had written a letter to Huckabee describing how he raped her at knife point in front of her 3-year-old daughter and all this kind of horrible stuff. But the plot thickens, and this isn't just your generic, and frankly, that, I think this ties back into 2 days ago when I pointed out how George W. Bush, was asked about the Saudi rape, and he gave the anti-Dukakis answer. Oh, I would have been furious, right? Well, this isn't just the Dukakis thing. This isn't just your generic Michael Dukakis kind of, the governor let somebody out, and they went off and killed somebody. When you get into it, you discover that there was a reason why Huckabee pardoned this guy, this rapist. And the reason why he pardoned him is because the woman that Dumond, is the guy's name, that Mr. Dumond had originally raped, the first woman that he had raped, a woman by the name of Ashley Stevens, was a high school cheerleader and a distant cousin of Bill Clinton and the daughter of a major Clinton campaign contributor. And so there was this whole right-wing campaign suggesting that the only reason that this guy was in prison was because Bill Clinton had been the governor of the state and a cousin of his was raped by this guy and she was the daughter of a major campaign contributor to the Clinton campaign and therefore he should be let out. And Huckabee then let him out in response to all this pressure from the right wing, mostly from Jay Cole, this Baptist minister and talk show host who's a good friend of the Huckabee family. And, you know, who went on and on and on about how, you know, in fact, a headline article, this was by Steve Dunleavy in the New York Post, who is also, you know, the right-wing spin machine. September 21st, 1999, he writes a column with the headline, Clinton's Biggest Crime, Left Innocent Man in Jail for 14 Years. And so Huckabee lets the guy out. And he goes off and he murders a woman after he rapes her. And now it's coming back to haunt him, but it's coming back to haunt him. But what's the interesting twist on this is it's not just, you know, as in the case of Michael Dukakis. Dukakis actually, you know, there was a program in Massachusetts to furlough prisoners who were capital crime criminals, which was put into place by the former Republican governor. And Dukakis ended that program while he was governor. But during that program, one of the guys that got let out was Willie Horton. But Dukakis ended the program that had been put in place by a Republican, and yet he was the one who got taken down for it. Now, is Huckabee going to get the same treatment? We'll see. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Tim in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Good morning, Tom.
Hey, Tim.
Let's see. Although I agree with you on the preference, my preference would be for to implement wind, solar, and geothermal as our primary means of generating electricity and power sources. I'd like to point out to you the December 2005 issue of Scientific American, and the cover story on that is titled Smarter Use of Nuclear Waste.
Yeah, well, Scientific American has been championing nuclear power for 40 years.
Okay. Well,
they have been absolutely unwavering in their support of nuclear power. I don't consider Scientific American a disinterested party, and the nuclear power industry has bought a lot of advertising in that magazine over the years.
Okay, that you know, that it's possible that could be true. However, let's talk about some new information here and see whether it's something that might be useful in helping with the mix of energy strategies that would get us down to you know, zero.
Here's the bottom line: why, you know, if we're concerned about carbon dioxide being toxic to us because it's poisoning our planet, why would we want to be increasing the amount of available poison for humans?
Okay, well, this just gets to the point of my call, which I'm trying to get to, and that is that there are two technologies, and one is called ATW, Accelerator-Driven Transmutation of Waste, developed what had been developed by Los Alamos, and another one that was the subject of the Scientific American article involving fast neutron reactors.
Right.
And anyway, the thing is these things are inherently, according to the articles and various other material sources I've read, inherently non-proliferating. They actually eat nuclear waste, or rather they reprocess waste that's actually produced by conventional reactors so that you're left with a small residue that is dangerous for, say, 300 years as opposed to hundreds of thousands of years.
Right, in theory.
And you wouldn't have to.
Here's Tim. My response to all that is you know, this is wonderful. If you guys can do this, cool. All you have to do is say, let's roll back Price Anderson. If the nuclear industry is so great, they don't need the Price Anderson Act. And I'm telling you, if you did away with the Price Anderson Act in the United States, there's not a single company that would go into the nuclear industry. Period.
Okay,
it wouldn't happen. Price Anderson says, you guys are not responsible for your actions. We, the taxpayers, will pick up the tab if there's a disaster. And you will not find an insurance company that will insure a nuclear power plant or any of these technologies right now.
Okay. Now, that may be one aspect of the problem. I'm not saying this stuff is ideal. I mean, after all, as I said, I'd rather see renewables. However,
Tim. There is no however. I'm not willing to go there. This stuff is poisonous. Why create more poison against biological things as an alternative to creating a poison to our atmosphere when we have technologies that don't create poisons? Pat in San Luis Obispo, California. Hey, Pat.
Hi. Well, my father worked at Lawrence Radiation Laboratory when it was in Berkeley. And PG&E tried to put a nuclear power plant in Bodega Bay, and it was on an earthquake, San Andreas earthquake fault. So my father, who worked for the radiation business, protested it. And then my father died, and they started, I lived down in San Luis Obispo, and we have Diablo Canyon, and my father's boss came and protested them building it, because it's also on an earthquake, you know, fault. And why do we have all these sirens? I'm talking about your lady, you know, talker. Why do we have all these sirens if it's not dangerous? A whole county is full of sirens. And why am I getting, you know, messages from our, you know, state government saying, do you think maybe we ought to put, like, some guns around it so we can shoot down anything that tries to crash into it? Because we have no protection there now.
Yeah, this was the huge aha when they figured out that Mohammed Atta was originally going to go after Three Mile Island or Indian Point, and that the only reason that he didn't was because he believed that it was surrounded by surface-to-air missiles. He came to the conclusion that this government would not be so stupid that we wouldn't have surface-to-air missiles around our nuclear power plants. And he was wrong. And we didn't have them then, and we still don't have them. And ground effect is meaningless. Speaking as a pilot, ground effect simply means that your stall speed is 10 knots, 10 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour, slower than it would have been without ground effect. So you simply slow down a little bit more. Gene in Napa, California, which actually makes it easier to maneuver into a small target. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Hey, good morning. These nuclear power plants are water intensive. Because they're, most of them that I understand are built on water resources of some kind.
Yeah.
And in a drought, there's not enough water to cool them.
Yes, and they have to scale back their generation of electricity.
Well, I think one even shut down in the Midwest somewhere, Tennessee or Kentucky or something like that, this past year.
Yeah.
And the other aspect of that for me is I have a question about the melting ice cap problem. Because of the water level rising that's predicted, will we have problems with protecting reactors from flooding?
That's right. Most of them are built at sea level because they have to be near a water source.
Yeah, so I'm wondering, you know, if there's going to be a gigantic price we're going to have to pay for that eventually if this keeps melting. And then one of the things that I like the idea that a lot of small things can make up for big things like not enough oil or coal. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I saw on a show once, and I wish I could just go out and buy one, was a rigging up your exercise bike with a generator, connecting it to generator, charging a portable battery. Mm. And then you can run all your small appliances off the battery.
Yeah, the larger issue.
Something like that.
Right, the larger issue that illustrates, Gene, and thank you for your call, is something that's going on right now in Portland. There's this company, Renewable NRG, here in Portland. In fact, they're advertising on KPOJ because the state and the city are offering all these tax credits. And you can, oh, and David informs me, in fact, we're going to have somebody from the organization on the air tomorrow. It's incredible. I mean, bottom line, you can solarize your house for free, for all practical purposes, because of all these various tax credits and things that are coming out. And then you've got something, you know, with this law, which is what they're doing in Germany right now. It's absolutely incredible how well it's working in Germany. I mean, I was just there a while ago, and the country, you take the train across the German countryside, and you see, you know, a quarter, a third of the houses, their south slopes, or roofs are covered with solar panels. They're generating enough electricity to have not had to build two nuclear power plants now in Germany as a consequence of this. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
No one to say it was no good what we done. I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Jim in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Jim, you want to disagree with me?
Yes, the program is very interesting, but I disagree. I'm an electric power engineer. I worked for 31 years for Pacific Gas and Electric. We have a large pump storage plant, and there's no question that you can develop some storage. but it's totally unrealistic to think that you could get enough storage to make wind and solar baseload resources. I just don't think there's enough sites available for pump storage to do that.
If all we were doing was pump storage, which is where you pump water up when you have surplus electricity and you bring it down through a turbine to generate electricity at you know, when you have a at night, for example, when the solar panels aren't working, I agree with you. But here's the question: if we're going to spend $15 million, $15 billion, should we be doing that to build new power plants, nuclear power plants, using this existing technology that we know produces toxic wastes? Or should we be taking that $15 billion and saying, let's develop some new ways to store energy?
I think, and we certainly should be doing as much as we can in that area. The question is whether it's realistic. You know, right now, we're getting ready for a teach-in on the 31st of January at the college to talk about global warming. And if you look at the DOE energy, something like 84% of our energy in the United States comes from fossil fuels.
Right.
Only a tiny percent of that comes from renewables. It just seems
to me... it's about 2.5% right now.
Yeah, it seems to me that it's unrealistic to think that you can replace all of that fossil fuel use with renewables. We certainly should do...
I agree, but we have nuclear power is providing about 16% of the electricity in the United States. And that came about as a consequence of a massive government-funded program, government-subsidized and government-funded program, giving huge amounts of money to companies that were created to create this nuclear industry. Why not do the same thing? I mean, the question is, ultimately, the question that's being asked is, do you want to die by radiation or do you want to die by carbon dioxide destroying the planet? And I'd say, I'd rather not die at all. Let's look at non-toxic ways to generate energy, and let's look at ways to conserve energy. We could probably, you know, the average European uses 1/7 as much energy as the average American. What do they know that we don't know?
Well, no, I don't. Look, I'm a big supporter of conservation. We should be doing everything we can to conserve. We're not going to conserve our way out totally of this. And I don't disagree with you about spending money on looking at these alternatives, but I just think it's not realistic to think that you can replace all of the fossil fuel use with renewables, and we need to do both. But I thought I would really love to get your information on this, the CO2 emissions for different alternatives. I think one of the things we've got to do is start looking at the total energy cycle of all these alternatives and determine which ones actually contribute to reduction of CO2 generation.
Yeah, I agree.
Is there a way to get that information that you...
The stuff that I was quoting, sure, I'll post it to my message board when I get off the air today. So it'll be over at tomharbin.com. We'll put the links to it there.
Okay.
Jim, we got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Rachel in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Rachel.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I wanted to explain that one of the big problems about nuclear energy that I don't hear anyone talking about is the tremendous problem of waste heat, which needs to be radiated into the environment in a world that's already suffering from overheating because heat can't escape into space because space is a vacuum and it doesn't really convect heat away from the Earth. When what we really ought to be doing is, you know, besides reducing our consumption like you explained to the last caller, but using our deserts and waste areas to collect solar, you know, because that way we actually reduce the amount of heat buildup and convert that into energy.
Convert it into kinetic energy and move people around and things. That's a good point, Rachel. Thank you very much. Gene in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gene.
Hi. One point I wanted to make is, I don't know if you're aware of Walter Russell. He was a 20th century American genius who actually had written many articles and solved a lot of these problems. But, you know, apparently because of the vested interests, his work was ignored. He wrote a book called Atomic Suicide, explaining why, you know, atomic energy was such a terrible idea scientifically. He also built an engine using hydrogen and showed it to NORAD, and it worked. Mm. I think this was like in the early part of the 19th century.
Yeah.
Because he knew, even back then, he talked about global warming, he talked about water shortages, he talked about the fact that the world needed a cheap, clean energy source.
Well, that's great. I'll have to keep an eye out for Walter Russell. Thanks for sensitizing me to that, Gene. I appreciate it. John in San Francisco. Hey, John.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I was living in southern Nevada in 2001, just just prior to the attack in 9/11, and I met a scientist from Yucca Mountain Project, and he told me how to get a pass and get a background check cleared and everything so I could go up and tour it. And I went up and toured the project, and the whole time we were getting a lot of kind of, you know, hurrah, hurrah for nuclear energy, and this is the best way to store energy and everything, or spend energy. And I said, okay, but, you know, there's such a limited amount of space here. There's only 75,000 tons or something like that that you can store here. And that's not a great amount of storage considering the amount of waste that's out there. What are you doing? What is the industry doing to discontinue creating more spent energy? And it was just dead silence. You know, they didn't want to hear that question.
Well, the industry doesn't care. The industry is protected. Price Anderson gives the industry just essentially immunity. I mean, we're paying for so many of these things with our tax dollars, and there are all these hidden costs. And frankly, it's the same. I will agree with Gwyneth, the author of the book. The coal is terrible, but it's like, you know, the choice shouldn't be which way do you want to die. The choice should be, hey, here are some life options. Let's look at them. You know, coal is, she's absolutely correct when she points out, coal is killing thousands of people a month in the United States. Several thousand people a month as a consequence of coal-fired power plants. We need to get off that as well, although the coal industry is sponsoring all the presidential debates. Gee, what an odd thing. What did the founders give up to create this country? Let's talk about that right after the break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back. Let's talk about political courage for a few minutes here. Pat Leahy, apparently tomorrow, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the senator from Vermont, is going to refer to the General Senate we'll see what happens, but the word is that possible criminal charges may be filed, contempt of Congress charges may be filed against Karl Rove, Alberto Gonzalez, some of the others involved in this whole, well, in a variety, actually, of scandals around the Bush administration. Henry Waxman is digging and digging hard into the crimes of the Bush administration. John Conyers looking at the crimes of the administration. Joe Biden using the word impeach and Bush in the same sentence in the last Democratic debate, and it never even got reported on by the media. He has done it again. You know, once again, he said, should Bush attack Iran without reasonable provocation and cause and without an act of Congress authorizing it, then Joe Biden would lead the move to impeach him. You have Dennis Kucinich and John Edwards out there taking some very unpopular positions with regard to large corporations and things like this, speaking out, Edwards basically echoing Franklin Roosevelt about the corporate the new dynasties, as Franklin Roosevelt referred to them. There is some political courage out there, and it's encouraging, but it seems like there's just a trace of it. You know, Franklin Roosevelt speaking in 1936 when he was nominated to run for his second term. This was before the war with Germany. This was before Hitler had even taken Austria, as I recall, before the Anschluss. It was certainly before the invasion of Poland, and, you know, long before we were viewing Germany as an enemy. He was speaking really about the Great Depression. He was speaking about the destruction of the infrastructure of America by the Republican economic policies that had preceded him, and talking about political courage.
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
Now, it's been a long time since we've heard that kind of language, and I would love to hear more of it. Consider the founding of this country. And this is such an important thing. Everything that we're doing, the old cliche of we're standing on the shoulders of giants is so true. You know, a dozen of the 56 guys who signed the Declaration of Independence were politicians, doctors, or ministers. 11 of them were merchants. 9 were farmers. Ben Franklin was kind of hard to define. He was a printer. He was a musician. He was a Renaissance man. There was also a teacher who signed the Declaration of Independence. There was a professional musician who signed the Declaration of Independence. The oldest was Franklin. He was in his 80s. The youngest was in their 20s. Thomas Jefferson at 33 was about the average age of the guys who signed the Declaration of Independence. These were the idealists of their day. These were the liberal children of the Enlightenment. While the conservatives of their day argued that America should remain a colony of England forever, these liberal radicals believed in both individual liberty and societal obligations. What a radical notion. A nation must care for the lives of its own, guarantee liberty, and ensure its citizens' happiness. This is a word that had never before appeared in the founding document of any nation. Totally radical concept. The signers wrote in the Declaration, "We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." And it was a simple statement of fact. The day they signed that document, each one of them legally became a traitor and was sentenced to death for treason by the legal government that controlled their lands and their homes. As Ben Franklin pointed out, they stood at the point of no return and, quote, "Indeed, we must all hang together, otherwise we shall most assuredly hang separately." When Rhode Island's Stephen Hopkins signed the Declaration of Independence, he remarked to his friend William Ellery, quote, "My hand trembles, but my heart does not." But Virginia's Benjamin Harrison, who weighed nearly 300 pounds, turned to Elbridge Gerry from Massachusetts, a short, thin man, and said, "With me, the hanging will be over in a minute, but you're going to be dancing in the air for an hour after I'm gone." A little gallows humor there. John Hancock, the wealthiest among them, and by today's standards, would just be considered the upper middle class, signed his name large enough that the king, to quote Hancock, "can read my name without glasses and can now double the reward," end quote, of 500 pounds that had already been put on his head for sedition. Just 6 months after he signed this document, the Declaration of Independence, John Hancock would lose his newborn daughter to complications of childbirth arising from his wife's fleeing the oncoming British army. Although wealthy by the standards of today, he would hardly qualify as rich by today's standards. He founded no dynasty, no foundations today dispense his money. His legacy, our nation. Another of the wealthiest of the signers was Thomas Nelson of Virginia, but a year after signing the Declaration, the British had seized his home and lands. When George Washington attacked the British in Nelson's hometown, Nelson encouraged George Washington to attack Nelson's own home, where General Cornwallis, the British general, had taken his headquarters. The house was damaged, and after the war, Nelson, unable to repay the loans he'd taken out against his home to help finance the revolution, lost much of his property and died in debt at the age of 50. Robert Morris, a Philadelphia merchant, lost all his ships. He was totally wiped out. William Ellery of Rhode Island signed the Declaration of Independence. He lost everything, as did Virginia's Benjamin Harrison, Pennsylvania's George Clymer, New York's Philip Livingston, Georgia's Lyman Hall, and New Jersey's Francis Hopkinson. The British destroyed New York's Francis Lewis's property and threw his wife into such a hellhole of a jail that she died 2 years later. 3 of South Carolina's 4 signers, Edward Rutledge, Thomas Hayward Jr., and Arthur Middleton, were captured by the British and held in a filthy, unheated prison and brutally tortured for over a year before George Washington, who, by the way, banned torture, freed them in a prisoner exchange. New Jersey farmer John Hart's wife died shortly before he signed the Declaration of Independence. Here is a single father with 13 children. After he signed it, he had to go into hiding. His 13 children were scattered among sympathetic families to hide them from the British and from the conservative loyalists. He never saw them again, dying alone and racked with grief 3 years later. Altogether, 17 of the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence were wiped out and died as paupers because of the war they declared. New Jersey State Supreme Court Justice Richard Stockton took his wife and children into hiding after he signed the Declaration, but conservatives loyal to the Crown turned them in. He was so badly beaten and starved in the British prison that he died before the war was over. His home was looted. His wife and children lived the rest of their lives as paupers. Altogether, 9 of the men in that room died, and 4 lost their children as a direct result of putting their names to the Declaration of Independence. Every single one of those 56 people had to flee their homes, and after the war, 12 returned to find only rubble. After the war was over and the conservatives had fled to Canada and England, the survivors of the new American nation met to put into final form the legal structure of the nation they'd just birthed. They said it wasn't going to be a nation of cynical, selfish libertarians who believed the highest value was individual freedom and independence from society, or that the greatest motivator was, as Ronald Reagan liked to point out, greed. No. And it wasn't to be a kingdom ruled by a warlord elite. That wasn't on the plan either, and you won't find that in the Constitution. It was not to be a theocracy. In fact, the Constitution explicitly said there shall be no religious test for public office. And it was not to be a feudal nation ruled by the rich. In fact, what kicked off the Revolutionary War in 1773 was a revolt against the largest corporation in the world, the British East India Company, in Boston Harbor, now known as the Boston Tea Party, as the result of a tax cut, not a tax increase. The Tea Act of 1773. It was a tax cut for the British East India Company, and the colonists said no. What kind of nation was birthed? As Benjamin Franklin told Philadelphia's Mrs. Powell after she asked what happened at the Constitutional Convention, what sort of nation is this going to be? He said, "It will be a republic, madam, if you can keep it." The question we're all facing now, can we keep it? Where is the political courage to stand up and speak the truth in this country? Where is the political courage among the people to participate in the political process to recapture this nation? Where is our political future? 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitled them. And John Adams came along and scratched that out and said, no, Christian God. And Thomas Jefferson said, no. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Happiness? These were liberals, after all. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. This was such a radical idea. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such a form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and their happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under an absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future and their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. And for that, he was declared a traitor and sentenced to death. Political courage. The Crypt reports, Senate Judiciary Chairman Patrick Leahy, God bless him, has scheduled a committee vote tomorrow, Thursday, on contempt resolutions against White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolten, former presidential political guru Karl Rove, for failing to respond to subpoenas. Under Judiciary Committee rules, the vote could be postponed for a week, but Leahy said he intends to move the criminal contempt resolutions as soon as possible. Last week, he rejected the White House's executive privilege claim in preventing Rove and Bolton from appearing before his panel, calling it overbroad, unsubstantiated, and not legally valid, setting the stage for Thursday's showdown. And then you've got the cons. Oh, you know, those founders, they didn't really intend for there to be a government that concerned itself with happiness. They didn't really intend for this to be a society where we are our brother's keeper, where we're all in it together, where you know, that has anything to do with the general welfare. No, that would be a terrifying thing.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yes, thank you, Ronald. Tell that to the folks in New Orleans. So in 1773, Jefferson and his friends signed, well, actually many of them were his political enemies, signed that document, the Declaration of Independence. And in 1886, the first draft of the Constitution, 1786, the first draft of the Constitution was, you know, they assembled and written. And it opens with this startling sentence, this single sentence, that lays out the vision of these people who fought and died to create this nation. We, the people of the United States, not we, the British East India Company, or we, the aristocrats. No, we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, capitalized union, establish justice, capitalized justice, ensure domestic tranquility, capitalized tranquility, provide for the common defense, defense not capitalized, promote the general welfare, welfare capitalized, and secure the blessings of liberty, capitalized, to ourselves and our posterity, capitalized. This is for us and our children and our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. I am seeing, here's the good news, I am seeing political courage arising again in this country. As I travel around the United States, I'm seeing it in every lecture hall and bookstore and theater that I stand up and talk in. And I'm not seeing it from me, I'm seeing it from the people who are showing up. And I'm starting to hear it from our politicians, and I'm starting to get it, that it is here now.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You can feel it in your very soul when you listen to the radio. Lord, my dark side in the sun.
34 minutes past the hour. Tomorrow, I'll be at the Willama Bookstore in Salem, Oregon at 2 p.m. doing a riff on Cracking the Code, my new book, and signing them. And next Friday, the 14th, December 14th, at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Memorial Union at 7 p.m. Be there or be square. Lee Larson sends me a note. The average European doesn't use 1/7 the energy we do. It's about half. And apparently he's right. I know that there's a 1/7 number out there. I'll bet it's what they use 1/7 the fossil fuels that we do, or 1/7 the gasoline. But in any case, it's still, you know, half. Okay, cool. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com, there's a blog there. And our topic, where is for this hour. Where is political courage to be found? What can we do to be politically courageous? And how can we encourage? I am so tired of the circular firing squad stuff. How can we encourage the best among us, among our politicians, to do more of what is the right thing? Christine in Ventura, California. Hey, Christine.
Hey, Tom. Thank you so much for the subject. And I'm actually the fifth great grandchild of John Hart. And
the guy who died after his wife had died, his children were scattered.
Yeah,
the signer
in New Jersey. And
wow.
I've only heard a little bit of stories from my grandmother, handed down from generation to generation. But in my personal life, I found myself. This was before I found out that I was related to John Hart. I'm a producer at a radio station, a very progressive radio station in Los Angeles, and I have been getting the issue out about H.R. 1955,
mm-hmm.
the habeas corpus for anyone. And I found that a few other people that I've met along my life who are related also to signers of the Declaration of Independence are doing similar things where they're alerting their fellow Americans about the dangers of fascism. And I think that would be a really great idea for you, maybe to even do a show one day where you're calling upon people who know that they're related to somebody who signed and encourage them to pick up the gauntlet, so to speak, and to do what their forefathers had done.
Yeah. My James and Dolly Madison didn't have any children, but James Madison's brother did, and he's my great something, I don't know how many greats, grandfather. My mother was in the process of going through the whole DAR thing it's enough to make you wonder about reincarnation, Christine.
I really think it would be great to have that if you could even just put a call out there and see who else, what they're doing, because it's really amazing.
Yeah, it really is. Christine, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening. I appreciate it. June in Portland, Oregon. Hey, June.
Hi. I'm an old woman now, but in the 30s, I was a little girl growing up in a small town in Canada's northern Ontario. And we were, of course, British subjects. And I remember learning American geography, American history, and I identified as a little girl with the rebelling colonists. So even then.
Oh, that's
interesting. I couldn't understand because I was I had a feeling of being wrong. I should be, angry at these people.
Oh, because you mean in the Canadian schools they were teaching that these American rebels were wrong.
Yeah.
They were the bad guys. We were the Americans were the bad guys, and the Canadians were the good guys.
The United Empire loyalists. Yeah,
right.
That's
fascinating. That's a great story, June. Thank you for sharing it with us. Dick in Seattle. Hey, Dick, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Tom, it's amazing to me that today we are framing this act of holding accountable Republican leaders who are clearly committed major capital crimes. But I think the bigger issue here is just what is this threat against those who seek justice in our country, and where does it come from? And aside from the go-along, get-along, sycophantic nature of, social beings, I think their threat is the corporate establishment media who have been the enablers of our corporate crime syndicate. And this is the same entity that has covered up all the major right-wing political crimes from the Kennedy assassination to 9/11, and the establishment left has joined in these cover-ups, probably influenced by the same media. And I wonder when you will find the so-called courage to learn and speak up against their complicity in 9/11 as well, because that's where it all started today.
Well, I think I do, and I think you just did as well. We've done programs on 9/11, and I'll be the first to tell you that I have absolutely zero confidence in the official story. None. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph.
Yeah, Tom, thank you very much for your truth and your passion about real American patriotism, folks who sacrifice their lives, their property, and their sacred honor for independence. Your passion and theirs explains why we lost in Vietnam and why we're losing in Iraq. I'm one of Limbaugh's stony soldiers. Unlike him or Bush or Cheney, I was there. We lost because what we were fighting was a thing called liberty. Now, they didn't think exactly like we were. They have a Buddhist tradition. They have various other differences.
In Vietnam.
in Vietnam.
Yeah, but they were nationalists. They were fighting for their country. They were repelling invaders.
And Tom, that's the biggest problem. I'm somewhat of a counterinsurgency buff, but that's the biggest problem with Petraeus' counterinsurgency manual.
Yeah.
Two things. One is he doesn't have the rebel side, not the American rebels, not the American patriots. He doesn't even include the book on the Vietnamese side. It's called People's War, People's Army.
Mm.
And that title tells you exactly why we lost.
Yeah.
We were fighting people.
And not just why we lost in Vietnam, and not just why we are losing in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also why the Soviet Union lost in Afghanistan, why the Soviet Union ultimately lost most of Eastern Europe. Why, frankly, I think, ultimately, if Hitler had successfully repulsed us and had held on to Europe for, another 50 years, I don't think he'd be in power today. I think the French would have eventually thrown him out.
Right.
And the Norwegians were in the process of throwing him out when we ended the war. I mean, there were independence movements all over Europe against the Nazis when the Nazis had only been there a year. Nobody likes to be occupied. Nobody. It doesn't work. It will not work over a long period of time. Ralph, thank you very much.
Tom, may I just one more comment?
Yes, sir.
I think the subtitle for Petraeus's counterinsurgency handbook should be the Occupier's Manual. It's very good in telling us how to do that.
Yeah,
thank
absolutely.
You.
You're welcome. It's what the British did in India. It's what, we need not recount world history. I think everybody knows it. Jim in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to say that there are some political heroes alive and well today, but they're not really spoken of as such. And one of them, the first one that stood up against George Bush that I know of is Richard Clark. The Czar of Terror, and then he was pretty much, they sent the hounds after him, and he just dropped off the map. Joe Wilson also should be labeled a hero, in my opinion.
Yeah, and his wife, Valerie Plame.
As well as Valerie Plame.
Yep.
And then Dennis Kucinich is somebody that's really trying to be a hero if we just let him. I think that he can do it. I'd also like to say one of the reasons we don't have, well, if in fact it's true that they've recorded every call, like I've heard, then just by our representatives knowing that, don't you think that would affect their decisions and their votes in Congress?
Yeah, I've often wondered how many Democrats are sitting around saying, okay, they know about this, they know about that, or Republicans for that matter. I mean, I guarantee you there are people in Congress with things to hide. They may be personal things to hide. Like with Larry Craig, they may be business things to hide, like with Duke Cunningham. I mean, who knows? But there are and they may not even be crimes. They may just but there are, and if they're sitting around going, oh my God, Bush has all my phone calls, where is that going to take people? It's pretty grim to think about, actually. Andre in South Carolina. Hey, Andre.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better.
I love the show. For reading the Declaration of Independence. My question concerns our participation, the people, the actual people of this republic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a 9/11 truth activist. I'm also very active in the political and local community. And I vote. And I think there are quite a few people like me who have become a lot more politically activated.
Yep.
And are doing things that are extraordinary. My question is, with all the effort that we're putting into this, without the representation in Congress, we seem to be getting nowhere. You as a general, I think you are a general in that you command a great deal of respect from a lot of people.
No, I'm a loudmouth rabble-rouser on the side. If you're going to compare me with somebody, I'd much rather be compared to Thomas Paine, who never held any kind of political office and just, yelled a lot, than George Washington, who actually had the courage to go charging off into combat, which I have never done.
Well, I mean, in that you speak a lot and you speak to the issues of our heart. If you were to give the word, you could command so many people into the streets of Washington.
It's not about me, Andre. It's about all of us. And see, this gets back to that issue that Chris Matthews said about how the Republicans are looking for a leader and the Democrats want to have a meeting. I want to have the meeting. I agree with him on that. This needs to be, there needs to be a critical mass reached by all of us, collectively, by we the people. And every time that has happened, that's what ended slavery. That's what led to the right of women to vote. That's what ended legal discrimination in the United States. That's what brought about the Social Security Act. That's what brought about the right to unionize. All of those things, none of them were the consequence of individual leadership. All of them were the consequence of the mass of the people creating, hitting a critical mass. And that's where we need to go with this. We need to be the 100th deer, the 50th deer. 45 minutes past the hour.
Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. I've gotten, just in the last 20 minutes or so, half a dozen emails from people, notes saying, you know, what was that you were reading from in the first hour? Well, in part I was reading and in part I was ranting, but it basically is from my book, What Would Jefferson Do? The thing about the founding, the founders, the people who signed the Declaration of Independence. Let's see here. Who wants to disagree with me? We'll go there first. Roque, is it, how do you pronounce that in Santa Fe, New Mexico?
Roque.
Hey, Roque.
Hi. I just beg to differ that all these founding fathers were such great heroes because they had just finished decimating all these Indian populations, taken their land, and the Indians were so devastated that they ended up taking arms against the colonizers with the English because they were so.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with you. I would put a caveat on that, and that is that the first people who were aggressively killing Native Americans and doing it enthusiastically were the pilgrims, the religious zealots who created theocracies in the United States, like in Massachusetts and in Virginia, and Pennsylvania was like the reaction.
Well, Franklin
fled Massachusetts when he was 17 because he didn't want to live in a theocracy. They were still torturing women as witches there. That's why he went to Philadelphia.
Did he not declare that the American Indian had to be eradicated in order for this new country to evolve?
Not to the best of my knowledge, but that sentiment was not absent among some of those founders. And Jefferson was actually in love with, I would say, the Native Americans. You read his notes on Virginia. Well, he goes on at length. He says that all the Europeans should interbreed with all the Native Americans because they're such a noble race. I mean, the point is that we have the history of this country for over 200 years is always doing better than the previous generation. So yes, they were racists and absolutely. I mean, look at what they did with African slaves. And there was a war of genocide. We have to acknowledge that. We have to look into our past and say that was a horrible time and we're ashamed of it and we have learned from it. And it wasn't consistent with the ideals they laid out. But those ideals were radical and dramatic at the time, even though they were narrowly circumscribed.
Well, they were borrowed from the ways that the Native Americans had been governing for years.
You're absolutely right. And Jefferson and Franklin, frankly, I mean, the 34 members of the Iroquois Confederacy were invited to the opening and spent 2 weeks to the opening of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. And Ben Franklin got up and gave a speech. He said, he was speaking of the Iroquois Confederacy, he said, if five nations of ignorant savages have been able to forge a bond that has survived in peace for 1,000 years, then certainly 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can do the same. He was holding them up. I mean, ignorant savages was not a slur at that time. He thought he was simply, you know, that was just the language of the time. Or maybe
that's
it was a
nice
slur.
Thing
I don't know.
To say when you're sitting on their land.
I know. As I said, okay, I'm agreeing with you, and I'm saying we can do better than that. We've got to move forward. We absolutely have to move forward. Donna in Monterey, California. But thank you for your comment. Madonna in Monterey. Hey, Donna.
Hi, Tom. I was there at your book signing in Carmel Front Row. I'm a direct descendant of Patrick Henry, and I have also taught my children, one's in her 20s and my son's in college, and my daughter's been arrested several times for speaking out and helping people with their land and their environment. And I'm saying, yeah, let's get together and talk about the people who are descendants of those great forefathers and how we can continue that message and pass it on to our children, because I think that, wow, yeah, we're doing something. I'm a great Kucinich and Edwards fan, but we have to continue that momentum and instill it in our children, because it's in my blood and I intend to pass it on and let them live it and carry it further.
Well said, Donna. Give me liberty or give me death. Patrick Henry's famous statement. Thank you so much for the call. Jeff in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just great. What's up?
I just wanted to let you know that I am a direct descendant of a Revolutionary War veteran.
Creep, they're coming out of the woodwork today.
By the guy, is a guy by the name of Solomon Trower, who actually had to change his name because he was wanted by the British for killing British officers.
Oh, my.
And oh my. I just wanted to let you know that I feel with you, and I definitely empathize because I have gotten extremely involved in the progressive movement since I've started listening to your show. I've read a few of your books, and I just wanted to let everybody in Chicago know that this Saturday at noon, there is a rally to help support John Edwards at the south end of Millennium Park near the ice skating rink at Michigan Avenue and Randolph at noon. I hope anybody who actually wants real change will come out and help support us.
Great. Thank you, Jeff, and thanks for your activism and being out there and doing the work you're doing. I appreciate it, and thanks for the call. Donna in Sonoma County, California. Hey, Donna.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. This is my first time calling. I'm a little nervous, but I met you at Project Censored book signing, and I really appreciate you letting me tell my story because I was an elected official fighting corruption in my town and was financially ruined and beat up physically and was actually homeless for a while. And I'm back in the town, and the reason why I'm calling is about political courage. When you were reading what happened to those other leaders, I thought, well, I just got to quit whining.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm still alive.
There you go. Yeah, yeah, it's true.
I can't believe all the people you've had with descendants of, I thought, well, I'm not a descendant of the forefathers, but my was Sam Rayburn, Speaker of the House.
Yeah, well, that's great. You know, Donna, it's interesting. During the last break, I went to the bathroom where they play here. I'm broadcasting from a Clear Channel station in Portland, Oregon, so they play Rush Limbaugh through the speakers because he's on one of the five stations that are broadcast out of this building. And as he's going into his break, he's going off about how, well, if the Iranians get a hold of the oil of the Saudis, you don't want to live in that kind of a world, do you? And it's like, these little fearful men, I just don't get it. They're so terrified. These guys are, oh, my God, we've just got to be. I'm sorry, if the Iranians got a hold of Saudi Arabia, they would have a war on their hands like you couldn't believe. The Persians, as the Iranians refer to themselves, have lived as a separate people, as it were, for hundreds if not thousands of years, and the Saudis the same. Tribalism runs so deep in that region. Nobody is able to occupy somebody else's land for a long time without the agreement of those people. I mean, it just doesn't happen. And it's, which is, you know, one of the many struggles that's going on in that region, is how do you work that kind of thing out? But it's just, it is so incredible, so tragic, frankly, how fear and terror are being peddled to the American people when we have a long lineage in history of being fearless and being refusing to being terrorized.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Today may well be a historic day, or should that be an historic day? Never was quite sure in American English. In British English, it would be an historic day. Because arguments are being laid before the Supreme Court about habeas corpus. This is so bizarre. Alberto Gonzalez actually said the Constitution does not grant rights of habeas corpus. Well, the Constitution doesn't grant rights to eat food or to get married. That doesn't mean that the Constitution doesn't grant any rights. The Constitution limits the powers of government. How this guy got through law school, I don't know. Michael Ratner is, speaking of Alberto Gonzalez, is who I'm talking about. Here's a guy who actually got through law school and learned what they had to say. Michael Ratner is with us. He is the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Their website, ccrjustice.org. CCR is in Center for Constitutional Rights and Justice.org. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
You are doing such great work. I am such a fan of your work. And tell us about your arguments today before the Supreme Court.
Well, it's the third time we've been before the Supreme Court on behalf of our clients imprisoned at Guantanamo. Some 350 are left. We thought we'd put this case behind us and gotten them the right to go to court to test their detention, what's called habeas corpus. We thought we'd done that in 2004. We thought we'd done it in 2006. Both times, our wonderful Congress, Republican-dominated at both times, overrode the Supreme Court decisions because they were not based on the Constitution but on statute. So this time we're actually up in the court on the question of whether the Constitution itself grants habeas corpus rights, or really the right to challenge your detention in court, whether the Constitution gives that right to the people who were jailed at Guantanamo. It's a big one. It's an important one. And hopefully it'll be the end of really 6 years of unjust imprisonment for hundreds of people at Guantanamo.
Or wouldn't another way to frame that be to say that you're arguing, the argument is whether the Constitution takes away habeas corpus rights during times of insurrection and insurgency, and invasion rather, which is what the Constitution says, and that we're not living in such a time.
There's no doubt here that, and even the Congress doesn't say it, and the government didn't argue, that the writ of habeas corpus is suspended because there's a rebellion or an invasion, which are the two circumstances under which you could strip habeas even from American citizens. No one's arguing that. The government's argument is, sad to say, is even worse than that, much more far-reaching. It's simply saying, not simply, but it's saying that non-citizens held at offshore penal colonies have no right to go into an American court to test their detention. Hear that again. Non-citizens held in offshore penal colonies have no right of habeas, and the habeas protection of the Constitution, what's called the suspension clause, simply does not apply to people at Guantanamo. So it's not, they're not even trying to invoke the invasion sort of criteria for suspending it. They're saying it has no application. We can treat these people however we want to treat them, and then they go to say we're treating them fairly.
Yeah. Going back to the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, the headline is Powers Forbidden to Congress. And the second paragraph, the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. Period. End of sentence. How can they argue that this doesn't, I mean, this, it's right there in the Constitution.
Well, it is, and the argument they make is that the time that part of the Constitution was written, 1789, and ratified, that the meaning of that was that it only applied in sovereign territory of the United States, and therefore people that are non-citizens held outside were not protected by it. We demonstrated in a number of cases that that wasn't the situation, that the United Kingdom had courts all over the place, as well,
including here. I mean, as early as 10 years before that point.
That's correct. I'm really glad you brought that, including here, including India, including the Channel Islands, all kinds of places, where if you're taken into custody, and think about it, if you're arrested by the king in that case, by the president in this case, captured, you should be able to just be detained in some offshore prison forever and never get to test your detention, just be disappeared essentially. Doesn't make any sense. It would be going back to really before King John at Runnymede in 1215 and the Magna Carta. So we don't, it's just an unacceptable argument, and hopefully the majority of the Supreme Court will find it to be an unacceptable argument.
Yeah, in 1773, before the Boston Tea Party, which has totally radicalized him, Jefferson wrote a paper, say a 30, 40-page essay, more or less, a summary view of the rights of British Americans, which was basically about how to be a good citizen in the Americas of Great Britain. And, I mean, at that point, it was clear that the right of habeas corpus was something that should be extended to all American citizens of the British Empire. And here we were, this distant colony. In fact, Georgia was established, the state of Georgia, it was established as a penal colony at one point for the British. And you know, it was one of the states that ratified the Constitution.
No, it's remarkable. But think about it. 200 and some years ago, 230 years ago, this was a right that everybody understood, that you just can't throw people in jail and throw away the key, disappear them and not give them attorneys and let them test their detention. We think if we got the opportunity to have a fair trial in front of a fair tribunal, that the majority, high majority of Guantanamo people would have to be released, and essentially it would mean the closing of an offshore penal colony.
Yeah. This is just one of many offshore penal colonies that we have, if the news reports are to be believed. What about the rest?
Well, you know, that's a big question. It came up in the court. Certainly the conservative judges, justices, were very concerned. It sounded like, well, first Guantanamo, then what happens in Bagram, which is, of course, in Afghanistan, and where we also have people who were probably mistreating as badly or worse than we did at Guantanamo, and what will happen then. And, of course, what we pointed out, this case, it depends on the fact at this point that Guantanamo is really part of the U.S. for all practical purposes legally. It has complete jurisdiction and control of Guantanamo. And, of course, to the extent Bagram also has complete jurisdiction and control by the United States, then, too, people at Bagram should have a right to at least say to a court, you got the wrong guy. And, you know, if you don't allow the courts to look at these, what you get is what we had in Guantanamo before we got attorneys there, you get torture. Because right. Secret detention and torture are essentially an equation. Secret detention equals torture.
Did you get any sense, Michael, in the arguments today before the Supreme Court that the justices get it, that the values of this country, that habeas corpus, the right to challenge your detention, to say, hey, you got the wrong guy, or let me prove that I'm innocent, or even, frankly, more importantly, that the government has to prove that you're guilty, that fundamental right is intrinsic to the DNA of this country. It's what we're all about, and it's what we're holding up to everybody around the world saying, this is us. You know, if you want to be like us, this is us. And we're not practicing what we're preaching?
Well, I certainly did not get that sense from three or four of the justices who were on the more conservative side, the Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, Alito, Scalia. Justice Thomas didn't say anything. Those four don't go there. What they're trying to do is trying to say, look, Congress has basically set up a process, these so-called military-type hearings at Guantanamo and a limited review, and essentially they said we're going to be loath to want to really reverse what the political branches have done here. They didn't say that outright. But
you're talking about the Military Commissions Act?
Right, that's the Military Commission Act. They don't get it. On the other hand, the moderate to more liberal justices, they get it, and Justice Breyer in particular said, look, this is 6 years. Isn't there an obligation to either release these people or try them? If you're not going to try them, release them. And at this point, we don't have what we call a preventive detention statute in the United States. There isn't one on the books. And until there is one, these people have to be charged or released. He really got it. He really said, 6 years? What are you guys doing here?
Yeah, we've got five. Kennedy is apparently going to be the swing vote again, do you think?
Well, that's correct. I mean, we have
a sense of which way he's going?
You know, Kennedy asked a lot of questions, and he asked a lot about the process that the government set up under the Military Commission Act and the Detainee Treatment Act, these sort of kangaroo court hearings where you don't get to actually see the evidence against you, where you don't have an attorney, and where you don't have a neutral panel. And he was questioning a lot, well, what's the review of that now? Maybe we should consider sending this back. And so we're going to win one way or another, but we may not win everything we want to, and that would be a disaster. Because the idea that there might be 2 or 3 years more delay while we figure out the legality of the so-called system the Congress has set up would really be, as I think you have practically said, a shame on every single value this country should stand for.
Yeah, and the Military Commissions Act sets up this whole entire third, you know, separate from the UCMJ and from the normal civilian justice system, this third kangaroo court system. It needs to be repealed as well, but that's a whole other riff. Michael Ratner, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccrjustice.org, the website. Michael, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And keep up the great work, and I encourage all of our listeners to go over there. They've got the ad that Fox News refuses to run for the Center for Constitutional Rights all over at ccrjustice.org. 16 minutes past the hour. John Bolton coming up next.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Talk to me when you're down now. You can talk to me.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Former Ambassador John Bolton is with us. His new book, Surrender is Not an Option. We had the ambassador on when his book first came out some weeks back. He's with the American Enterprise Institute, AEI.org, for more of his writings and goings-on. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
And thank you for being with us. How are you guys who are in favor of attacking Iran, if I'm accurately characterizing your position, going to convince the American people that we actually need to attack Iran in the face of this national intelligence estimate?
Well, I certainly don't have hope that we come to the point of attacking Iran. I've always felt it was useful as a last resort. But, you know, this intelligence estimate, I think, is the result of politicization within the intelligence community of supposed intelligence analysts really putting their own policy preferences forward disguised as intelligence judgments, because many of the people who were involved in writing this I knew when they were at the State Department. They're not intelligence community professionals. They're foreign service officers. And what they say in this NIE, they could have said 5 or 6 years ago. Here's the key point. Even this NIE makes it plain that Iran did have a military program and has only moderate confidence that, in fact, that program remains suspended. But even more importantly, says quite obviously, as we all know, that Iran continues to enrich uranium. And that is critical to either a civilian or a military program, because if you're going to decide to go for nuclear weapons at some point, you have to have highly enriched uranium.
Or if you're going to run a nuclear reactor and generate electricity, you have to have 3% enriched uranium, which is apparently what they're doing, according to IAEA.
Right. That's all that they're doing now. But, you know, even though you need enrichment to 90% of the U-235 isotope, when you get to 3 to 5%, you've done two-thirds of the work needed to get the highly enriched uranium. So they're building up an inventory that gives them the potential to break out at a time and a manner of their choosing. The irony of this report is that while it says that diplomatic pressure works, the effect of the report is to dissipate the Bush administration's own diplomatic efforts. This is a clear signal to Tehran. They can do what they want to do, in effect.
Are you suggesting that this is essentially a coup within the intelligence community or within the State Department or both by an unelected cabal in the intelligence community? And then sometime back, of course, we had, you know, the head of CENTCOM saying all this discussion about bombing Iran is not productive. The military seems to be pushing back. The intelligence, this is John Abizade saying, you know, this is not a good thing. Why are they pushing back?
As I say, in terms of the intelligence community, they're not supposed to be making policy prescriptions.
No, but they work for Bush. I mean, he's their employer.
Well, that's part of the problem is they don't think they do work for Bush. And this is something that has developed over time, over a number of administrations, but particularly in this administration, the intelligence community is not an independent agency.
So you're suggesting that their alliance is to, or their allegiance rather, is to a particular ideology rather than to the truth. What is that ideology?
Well, I think given the background of many of the people who wrote this, that they never favored a strong policy toward Iran's nuclear program from the get-go. So I think they're trying to spin the intelligence in a way that makes it harder to take a tough line. But again, I want to emphasize, even if you took them at face value that diplomatic pressure would work, the impact of this report is to prevent Bush from assembling any diplomatic pressure.
So you're suggesting that these guys are doing something that's essentially treasonous. They're harming the ability of the United States to function in a dangerous world.
Well, I think they've made it. If you look at press reaction and government reactions around the world, the Chinese have already said there is no need for a third Security Council sanctions resolution. Now, I've never felt these sanctions resolutions were going to dissuade Iran from pursuing nuclear weapons to begin with. But even such minimal steps as another Security Council resolution now looks to be essentially impossible.
So, to phrase the question in a positive, you know, I said, what is the agenda of these guys if this is a cabal that's essentially, you know, executed a coup within the executive branch, apparently? And you said that their agenda is to not have what you described as a strong confrontation with Iran. How would you describe that in positive terms? And I don't mean positive in a moral sense. I mean in a behavioral sense. What is it that they're trying to accomplish as opposed to what is it that they're trying to prevent?
Well, you know, it's I would say with a medium amount of confidence, to use intelligence jargon, that they're hoping this makes it much harder for the president to engage in either regime change or the use of force. And, you know, that's a position that a person can legitimately take. Reasonable people can argue about it. But what I'm concerned about is that under the guise of a supposedly objective intelligence estimate, they have infected it with their own policy biases. And I think that's impermissible.
Isn't that a crime?
I don't think it's a crime as – no, I don't think it's a crime. But I think it's a violation of their obligation.
Should Bush fire them?
If he could, you know, part of the problem here is that the career system makes it very hard to fire people. And the president himself, I have to say, yesterday looked completely stunned at this news. And I don't think there's going to be much of a response.
Yeah, interesting. Ambassador John Bolton, American Enterprise Institute, AEI.org, the website. His book, Surrender is Not an Option, Defending America, the United Nations, and Abroad. Ambassador Bolton, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Well, thanks once again for having me. Appreciate
it. Talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Just a quick reminder, tomorrow at 2 o'clock in Salem, Oregon, I'll be at the Willamette store talking about my new book, Cracking the Code, and signing books. Doing a, 30, 40, 50-minute speech on the topic. And next Friday, a week from Friday, I'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota at 7 p.m. at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Memorial Union. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Well, we just had John Bolton on the program. And, you know, it's got to be getting tough for these guys who want so much to have Iran. Well, I don't want to characterize his position without him, or in a way that essentially contradicts what he says. But it sure seems, let's say that Vice President Cheney so much wants to bomb Iran. I don't know if John Bolton wants to or not. You know, he explicitly said, no, he doesn't want to bomb them. He hopes it doesn't come to that. He'd rather just see them not have a nuclear program. Yeah. I wonder if they didn't have a nuclear program, would it be, we just don't want them making IEDs? Is there always something next? I don't know. But whatever it may be, they're getting pushback on these things, and they're getting significant pushback. I mean, here, John Abizaid pushing back. He says the key is to figure out how we don't turn this into Samuel Huntington's Battle of Civilizations, and we work toward an area where we respect mainstream Islam. I mean, say what? And the former commander of CENTCOM, and then the current commander, more recently, has come out and said, "No, wait a minute! All this discussion about bombing Iran is not a good idea." And here now we have this NIE, and the question that's being asked repeatedly is Bush in the timeline here? I mean, at the same time that Bush was talking about World War III, he knew that they were reconfiguring the intelligence on Iran. And maybe he knew that they were saying, hey, you know, they don't have a nuclear program. So was he stupid or was he lying? And, I mean, I'm not the one saying that. This is Joe Scarborough, the former Republican member of the House of Representatives who led the impeachment of Bill Clinton. Joe Scarborough on his television and radio program this morning. Here he is.
And again, we are left with only two options here. Either the President of the United States is lying to the American people about what happened during that meeting, or the President of the United States is stupid.
There you go. So, which is it? 1-866-303-2270. David in San Francisco. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. You know, I've always contended that he's definitely not stupid, that they're saboteurs, frankly.
I agree. Yeah. I do not believe that for a minute that George Bush is stupid. He may be inarticulate, but he is not stupid. He's shrewd.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can see it, you know, just this whole business about the intelligence estimate, and they're pretending that he didn't know it 2 weeks ago. No, he knew it. This thing was written 4 years ago.
Well, in its current incarnation, it was apparently written just before the elections of 2006. And, you know, clearly they wouldn't want to let it out before the elections. You would have even more Democrats elected.
But, well, I'll tell you, the way I'd lay it out in terms of a crime is misappropriation of government funds. If he has a whole bunch of cronies that are lining up with their hands out for government contracts based upon planning regarding the invasion of Iran, if he's got his buddies already cranked out selling options on their oil, selling options on the rebuilding, selling options on everything else.
Moving their headquarters to Abu Dhabi.
Right. Yeah, so with that in mind, he's misappropriating government funds when he knows the truth is that his whole sales force is selling a line, and they're using taxpayer dollars to do it. So it's misappropriation of government funds just at its basic. But then the idea that Congress, he's able to do the double whammy because he's essentially made this top secret. And 4 years ago when this data was not released to Congress or only to a select few, and who were those select few, and will they be able to open their mouths because it's releasing government top secret data? Well, it turns out the top secret data was an outright, you know, that there was no truth to what he was huckstering, but he's made it against the law for them to save America.
Yeah.
So it's you know, these guys, I look at it, it's plain sabotage. And for somebody like Bolton, I mean, I couldn't even believe it when I heard you were interviewing him. How was he dumb enough to even come on a show like yours? But, you know, they're...
Well, I was treating him respectfully. I think that at a certain level, many of these people are actually, I mean, I think that, And I'm pretty sure that John Bolton is one of them, although maybe I'm a bad judge of character, but I think that they actually believe their own ideology. They actually believe their line. And if they believe, you know, if John Bolton really and truly believes that that is the best thing for the United States, I think that you have to at least respect that he believes that that's the best thing for the United States. And even though I strongly think that he's wrong, and
you well, know. You know, when he was what, an undersecretary to of state to
yeah.
various places, and,
yeah, he was...
and those various places usually had to do with, I mean, when you're sitting in that office, you get reams of documents regarding water issues and health care issues. And
well, I think his most significant role was pounding on the windows in 2000 down in Florida, trying to shut down the recount.
Well, sure, but
I mean, everything since then has been, thank you very much.
Yeah, Bolton in particular, though, I'm thinking even before 9/11, the average day was 35,000 kids starved to death per day worldwide. 35,000 children starved to death worldwide. Now, he was a both the United Nations as well as the State Department. And when you see that 35,000 children starve to death every day, much less how many are dying from bad health care and all sorts of other things, you can't go ahead with policies that are designed to hog money away from the funding programs that feed starving kids without having utter callousness and really master race basics. So I that's why I say, you know, he's a saboteur, and it's all based on master race junk.
Yeah,
you know, these
well,
guys are
you know,
scammers from way, way back, about 1933, I'd say.
Yeah, I'm not thank you, David. I'm not ready to paint anybody with that particular brush, although I have no doubt that there are such people in this administration. But I'm also... Well, I'll just leave it at that. Rich in Connecticut. Hey, Rich.
Hi. A couple of days ago, John Bolton was on, I think it was the Situation Room, and he was being interviewed and asked about attacking Iraq. This is before the NIA came out. And he made a statement about when it comes to going to war, you don't listen to the military commanders. You listen to the civilian leadership. That contradicts everything this administration has been saying for justification for staying in Iraq.
Yeah, but the flip side of it is that that's absolutely consistent with the Constitution.
But the problem with it is if you apply that, how do you get to, you listen to the civilian leadership to go to war, but to stay at war, you ignore them.
Oh, I know. It's
I mean,
your point is well made and well taken, that the Bush administration is talking out of one side of their mouth when it's convenient. They talk out of the other side of the mouth when it's convenient to do that. The reality is that the founders had in mind that the military of this country would be on a very, very, very short leash, and that leash would be in the hands of people who are elected by we the people and answerable to we the people.
But the problem is, he made this statement towards the end of at the very end of his interview, and it was allowed to slide. Nobody called him on it. Why don't they say, okay, John Bolton says this about going to war. Why don't we use it for getting out? I mean, why don't we
Bush cherry picks his military leaders, and you end up with General Petraeus. He goes through military leader after military leader until he finally gets the one who says the thing that he wants, so that then he could say, hey, we're doing what the military leaders say. And most Americans are so ignorant of how the Constitution is written and how our form of government is put together, and thank you for the point, Rich, that they don't get it. You know, I mean, ever since the Reagan administration, when war was declared on civics education in the United States, because after all, it was being taught by those godless communist unionized teachers. And so we've got to strip critical thinking and discussion out and the true history. Oh, they're studying the labor movement? Oh, we can't have that. And, you know, the dumbing down of America has happened hugely since the Reagan administration, and, you know, and then the final straw in the coffin, or nail in the coffin, No Child Left Behind. Anyway, George in Longmont, Colorado. Hey, George, we've got about a minute before we got to take a break. What's in your mind?
Hey, Tom. Well, I think that very obviously that Bush's response to the NIA investigation report really smacks of his conflict with reality, and it just really shows that this guy is out of touch with reality. And he is just so wrapped up into his own definition of reality. Of course, he's probably got a whole bunch of neocons behind him, and they're just as insane as he is. But nevertheless, I mean, I think that is very significant.
Yeah. This is the point I made on this program yesterday that Joe Scarborough picked up on this morning, which is that Bush can't have it both ways. He can't say that the people who work for him, the intelligence community works for him for a year, has had this national intelligence estimate together and informed him that it existed. And he never bothered to say, oh, would you please tell me what it says? Because I'm out there talking about this issue every day. If that's the case, then he is, as Joe Scarborough said, stupid. And I don't believe it. And if that's not the case, if a year ago he said, okay, what does it say? And they told him, and he decided to tell us something different, I would say he is in violation of his oath of office. He took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, and implicit in that is to tell the truth to the American people. And if he's been lying to us all these months about this, and perhaps years, that is an impeachable offense.
Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Oh, this is interesting. The Iranian news service, actually, this is from Agence France-Presse, the French press service, but it's out of Iran. It's published on the Iran-focused newsletter, and a tip of the hat to Blue in Missouri for tracking this down in our chat room. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad called on Tuesday for the creation of an Islamic court to try war criminals and other international felons. He said an international Islamic court should be formed to prosecute international criminals, those who violate nations' rights, war criminals, and the ones who threaten human life without any fear, he told the conference in Tehran. Now, I recall back when, just before we started bombing Afghanistan, that the Taliban said that they would hand over Osama bin Laden for trial, but not to us, presumably to an Islamic country. I wonder if that's the kind of thing that Ahmadinejad had him. Somehow I doubt it. I think he's suggesting that there be an Islamic Nuremberg trial. And what are we going to do? In his ideal of this, which I think many Muslims would say is anti-Islamist, what are they going to end up with, taking people into the soccer stadium in Jeddah on Friday for beheadings and things? I mean, actually, we have the death penalty here, too. Bob in New York City. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Yeah, hi. I'm a veteran of World War II, and I thought prisoners of war are just taken and put in prison camps, and that's it. No lawyers, nothing, and whatever the army or the whatever they decide to let them go, they let them go. What's with lawyers in this? I don't understand.
Well, first of all, prisoners of war do have rights, and they, you know, and by international treaty. We want our prisoners of war to have rights. We give rights to other people's prisoners of war. But the guys held in Guantanamo are not called prisoners of war. The Bush administration is not asserting that they are prisoners of war.
What are they?
They call them enemy combatants, which is a new category that they created of whole cloth that never existed before.
There's no prisoners of war.
That's right. They are not prisoners of war. If they were prisoners of war, then under the Geneva Conventions, there would be certain things that they could do and many things that they couldn't do. And they could be held there until the end of hostilities, et cetera. But, no, they are not prisoners of war. This is a whole different thing.
Let me ask you a question about torture. If they had your family, your mother, your father, sisters, brother, and they were threatening to cut their heads off, what would you, and they had somebody to get information, what procedure would you want them to use?
I would want them to use the most sophisticated and effective techniques possible. And what we know for sure, Bob, is that that is not torture. Torture does not produce the result. It does on TV. It does in the movies. And you've been watching too much TV and too many movies if you believe this. But if you listen to the intelligence officials, if you talk to people who do interrogation for a living, and they'll tell you that in a very short period of time, it is possible to turn people around and get them telling you the truth rather than simply going, I'll tell you anything you want, just stop sticking those things under my fingernails.
Well,
torture doesn't work, Bob. I'm sorry, it doesn't. Tony in San Diego, California. Hey, Tony.
Okay.
Tony, you're on the air.
Hi,
Tony?
Hi, Tom?
Yeah.
Tom, I'm sorry, I could barely hear you. I just want to say that... I'm in the military. It's an honor to speak with you. You're probably one of the most intelligent, one of the most articulate person that I've ever heard on the radio talking about politics. And real quick, and I know that you're busy, but I try to talk. I sometimes listen to Mr. Limbaugh just to know what the enemy is thinking. And I got to tell you, it scares me, and I sometimes have to turn to your radio just to, you know, get to your radio station just to get some common sense.
Okay, well, thank you, Tony. Thank you very much. And
that's all I want to tell you. I just want to say keep up the good work, I'm just ashamed that we don't get that on the Armed Forces Network radio. We do not get your radio station. I brought it up sometimes, it's something that they don't want to talk about.
Yeah, well, keep letting them know. And, Tony, thank you for your service to our country, and thank you for your kind words. It's much appreciated, and thanks for listening there in San Diego. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. Did you notice, just an observation on the press conference, did you notice that the president gave that wink of an eye at the end there?
Yeah. I did. The smirk,
can I play Shrink a little bit, if I may?
Very quickly. We're just about out of time.
This gung-ho fraternity type energy he likes to show off is disgusting. For a man who's supposed to be the leader of our country and the free world,
George Bush never stopped being a frat boy. I mean,
but he's wrong.
Yeah. No, he was in prep school at Andover. You know, his roommate was L. Paul Bremer. Gee, what a surprise. And he's always been about being a frat boy, and he's still a frat boy. And frankly, that's not what I want for president. Doug, and thank you very much for listening to WPTT, too. Doug in Staten Island, New York, listening to WWRL. Hey, Doug.
Well, thank you. I was going to call about the military use of force and the tortured reasoning between Razul and Hamdi and so on, and the predicates that are followed by the ideological bent of the Supreme Court, in which they say, well, we've dotted the I's and crossed the T's and done the bells and whistles, but there's still no practical relief if you go along with that. But after listening to Mr. Bolton, I see a moment in time frozen. I see the ideological bent of Mr. Bolton. I have the advantage of having seen him on CNN International yesterday when the anchor tried to ratchet him down and say, Mr. Bolton, are you saying all 16 intelligence agencies are wrong? And he says, oh, you're quite wrong on that. The Energy Department didn't go along with it. This is the man who poo-pooed Sandir and the Los Alamos labs for the centrifuges and such. And listen, on your radio, I want to say, on August 23rd, 2005, Democracy Now! Reported on a Washington Post article which said, quote, the traces
yeah, Doug,
of
Doug,
uranium...
I'm sorry. We're just plain old flat out of time. I'm really sorry. And we don't do reading on the program. Coming up tomorrow, Larissa Alexandrovna on her investigation of the architects and execution of backroom Republican politics, Christy Harvey of the Center for American Progress, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.